Lecture 3. Sterne, Tristram Shandy.
For Lecture 3, which is one less than four, one more than two, I'll talk about Tristram Shandy. Talk, I say. But really, I'm going to hold forth, perhaps sermonize, as if you were in church. Now, who goes to church among you? I wonder. Wonder itself is a much finer quality than sermon. Well, where are we? Lecture 3, not 4, not 2, on Tristram Shandy. That was a poor effort to show you what a digression is. It's the enemy of any kind of clear utterance. It works through association. It wrecks bottom-line thinking. Sterne is the master of it. God knows you've all been exposed to people where you think, get to the point. Finish what you're saying. This book never gets to the point, never finishes what it's saying, and that's part of its charm, it seems to me. It is the oddest narrative in English literature. And it makes us realize, and this is why I chose it, to follow Moll Flanders, which is such a straightforward book, it makes us realize how free, playful, impudent, and inventive a novel might be, that there is no fixed form for telling a story. And once you've seen that, then you begin to think, well, maybe the rules that govern the way we write are also rules that are not written in stone that govern the way we think. Maybe we could think in a freer, more liberated, emancipated way. Sterne's book, it seems to me, is one of the tonic texts we have for learning to at least imagine those possibilities. And so we follow the straightforward Defoe with the capricious Sterne, a book that seems to enjoy going inside out, to stick its tongue out at its own conventions, in order to see just how capacious and rich the novel form is, how much it can encompass. It's not something you first see if you look at this big, thick book, which was written over a period of years, published in installments, because it has tons of learned references in it, Latin, Greek, Dutch, Biblical, French, and they're not just footnoted. Often they're cited at length and in the foreign languages. The modern reader, who usually has not these languages, looks at this and sees a world of ruins, and I think that's how Sterne saw it. A world of ancient authority, which no longer resonated even then, and certainly does not resonate today. And in that light, this book can be really surprisingly modern. It reminds us of a classical modern text like T.S. Eliot's poem, The Wasteland, or Joyce's Ulysses. Now, the 18th century had a great reverence for what was called the learned tradition, and Sterne has some of it, but Sterne also wants to mock it. How would you mock the learned tradition? I shall quote a passage, and you'll see if you think he's mocking it. Gastropheres, for example, continued Kissarsius. Now, you've got to think this is English pronunciation. Kissarsius is a Latin version for Kissasius. Baptizes a child of John Stradling's in gamini gatris, etc., instead of in nomine patris. Is this a baptism? No, say the ablest canonists, inasmuch as the radix of each word is hereby torn up, and the sense and meaning of them removed and changed, quite to another object. For gamine does not signify a name, nor gatris a father. What do they signify, said my Uncle Toby? Nothing at all, quote Yorick. Such a baptism is null, said Kissarsius. Well, this is the kind of fun and games that this text enjoys. And you can see that at some point, wordplay becomes a little bit more threatening, a little bit more hostile to established values, because it's baptism that's being mocked, turned into a game, played with in this passage. Sterne is obsessed with rules. The only thing he's more obsessed with is breaking them. Of course, you can't break the rules if you don't know that the rules are there. He loves making fun of people who themselves are stuck in the rules. One of the great actors, great Shakespearean actors of his day, was Garrick, whom Sterne worshipped, and Sterne enjoys pointing to the various theater critics who sit in the theater to watch Garrick playing Hamlet, and all they can, it's as if they had a stopwatch on their wrist, and all they can measure is whether Garrick is going to do it exactly by the rules of grammar and histrionics that have been passed on in the books. And he figures they miss everything. They miss all of the fun and vitality of the text. And of course, when Stern talks about Garrick, he's talking about himself, that the critics are going to probably nail him as well for not following the rules or for turning the rules upside down. Well, if the old rules don't bind, I hope you can hear how much of an echo there should be in that phrase, if the old rules don't bind. I mean, that's the modern condition. That's the modern world. Nietzsche was to say God is dead centuries later, or a century and a half later. But when the old rules are just a kind of cemetery of ruins, then we have to figure out, what is authority? What are the new rules? How do we write? But also, how do we live? How do we behave? Stern offers us an extraordinarily modern answer, which is conscience. Conscience, he calls, the knowledge which the mind has within herself. At which point we realize that conscience is really the sibling to consciousness, the modern term, that there, it's the realm of subjectivity, not rules, that we live in. Except that Stern is also aware that conscience and consciousness, even if it is our so-called modern God, that's his term, is not reliable. I quote Stern, "This domestic God was either talking or pursuing or was in a journey or poor adventure, he slept and could not be awoke." In other words, how much can you depend just on subjectivity for learning how to behave? It seems to me that Tristram Shandy is a book that tries to create an answer to this double dilemma. On the one hand, tons of rules out there, tons of authorities, dead languages, dead examples, dead precepts that live perhaps in libraries and in churches, but aren't living anymore. And on the other hand, consciousness. But are they reliable? How do you somehow walk the tightrope between these forces? And so Tristram Shandy is the book he wrote to break the rules while mocking them, to celebrate individual consciousness and subjectivity. The greatest critic of the 18th century, Dr. Johnson, did not think much of Tristram Shandy. He famously said, "Anything that is odd won't last long." I hope that my lecture is at least some proof that he was wrong, that it has lasted, but it is certainly odd. If you pick up this book and thumb through it, you're going to see pages that are black, pages that are speckled, pages that have little scribbles on them that look like a Rorschach test. This is not the way we think novels are supposed to be written. It was a successful book then. So Johnson was fighting a kind of rearguard activity to say, well, they like it now, but they won't like it long. I tried to suggest to you in my opening remarks about lecture 2, but less than 4, more than 3, etc. I got that one wrong. 3, between 2 and 4. And then to move from one verb to another verb. But it's also the case that when we really seriously describe anything, we can get stuck. This book putatively describes the life of Tristram Shandy. But think about describing your own life. How could you possibly even get past the first day if you were thorough about it? Or the first hour, there was so much you could find to say. And so in Stern's book, things become cancerously expansive. And he writes and he writes and he writes and he continues to find more to write without moving forward. He goes sideways, he goes backwards, he goes into the conditional, the subjunctive. He tells us about background and foreground and other grounds, and yet Tristram's story rarely gets forward. It's digression. And digression, Stern actually calls the soul, the life, the sunshine of literature. Those are interesting terms, soul, life, sunshine, as if these are the energy sources. This is what makes it live. So if digression is not giving us a story that moves forward, well, what is it giving us? And why is Stern doing it? At one point, Stern says, you know, even if you wanted to, if you were a thinking person, you can't go forward. Listen to the extraordinary metaphor he gives us here. Could a historiographer drive on his history as a muleteer drives on his mule? Straightforward. For instance, from Rome all the way to Loreto, without ever once turning his head aside, either to the right hand or to the left, he might venture to foretell you to an hour when he should get to his journey's end. But the thing is, morally speaking, impossible. And he could have easily said, morally speaking, or in terms of conscience and consciousness, in terms of the noise and play and banter that goes on 24/7 in our head, we don't go forward like that. Maybe, in fact, we're not supposed to be going forward. If you're not going forward, but you're going sideways and you're writing a digressive text, you've shifted your center of attention from the presumable plot of your story. Where? Well, it seems to me the answer is obvious. To your reader. The reader is brought into this book. The reader is the person who is addressed, not the story being told. I'll give you Stern's way of writing a digressive paragraph. I told the Christian reader, I say Christian, hoping he is one, and if he's not, I'm sorry for it, and only beg he will consider the matter with himself and not lay the blame entirely on this book. I told him, sir, and then he continues, and he continues to get even further lost. Well, the question is, do we ever get to the point? Does anyone get to the point, to the bottom line? How often do we, in fact, bob and weave and go in all other kinds of directions? One origin for this kind of writing is Stern's interest in Locke, the philosopher. And in particular, he takes Locke's notion of free association, that the mind works metaphorically. It goes from one idea to another where there may not be a logical connection. And it just sort of shifts gears. It's like a carrefour, a crossroads, goes somewhere else. In this sense, we're always thinking analogically, metaphorically. As you can imagine, this can give logic a hard day. And it can also make conversation difficult. Stern labels this behavior hobby horse. It's a funny term. A hobby horse actually existed in 18th century England. It was like a rocking horse that children used. But Stern wants to suggest that this kind of child's toy represents the kind of odd, frivolous, capricious way that we think. And of course, a hobby horse you could imagine as a way of going somewhere, as a kind of carriage of sorts. There are a lot of implications to this that I think are worth drawing out before I get further into the book. One is that it leads to a view of life as largely private and solipsistic. In other words, if I operate almost always by free association, and if a kind of common, universal logic doesn't govern my phrases or even my thinking, then it turns out that I almost need a decipherer, a decoder, because it's my own private logic, my own internal logic that seems to be in play here. And this is very hospitable to one's obsessions. And so Stern's characters speak past each other. X will say something and Y will say something else, not because of what he heard from X, because of what it triggered in his own mind. And you can decide for yourself whether your own conversations follow that model or not. But to take this notion of privacy even further, I think Stern's view of life and of the way the mind works and its free associative character also suggests that we are in some sense locked out of other people's actual being, that we live in an opaque world, that we can see people. We can see their skin, we can see their form and their figure, we can hear what they have to say, but we cannot see the mechanism that's in their mind that is producing the logic behind what they are saying. And Stern writes about that. He writes about it in the sense that he thinks that it would be great if we did have access to other people's minds. And he doesn't think that we do. And so he tells us instead that it would be great if we could go in with what was called in his day Momus's glass. It's like a glass instrument, like a looking glass, that looks directly inside the mind of others. Can you imagine how useful it would be if you had one of those for every conversation you have, where you just sort of turn this little instrument on, and then you see what's really being thought inside the person who's speaking. And Stern is very funny in the way he describes it. He said, if you had a glass like that, you could easily understand other people's character. All you would have to do, he says, is to take a chair, go softly, as if you were looking in a beehive, and look in, and you would view the soul stark naked and observe all her motions. You could watch exactly how ideas are formed inside of the people whom you're listening to or whom you care about. But, he says, such an advantage is not to be had by the biographer in this planet. And he says again, and this is, I think, a very rich and sad utterance, our minds shine not through the body, but are wrapped up here in a dark covering of uncrystallized flesh and blood. And therefore, if we want to understand the character, the personality, the values, the reality of the people that we're dealing with, there is no transparency to be had. We have to go by other kinds of means. And I think Stern is actually going to suggest that the best way to do it is to pay attention to their particular obsessions, their own free associative pattern, etc. That may tell you, give you a better key as to what they're really like. Now, Stern's world is a funny world in the sense that even though he cannot take anything to its conclusion, he's like a juggler who has lots of balls up in the air at the same time. He enjoys leaving his characters in mid-speech, in mid-air, and he drops them, and he goes on to other topics altogether. He'll have someone absolutely in mid-speech, and then he goes on and takes up another topic. If I were to stop in mid-speech, I would be stopped. You'd all be either watching or listening, and there'd be nothing coming from me. So the people themselves are frozen. But the writer, and this is what I'm leading to, is never frozen. The writer is the person who has the kind of force, power, muscularity to treat his characters as frisbees, as balls in the air, as objects that you can play with. So why not have them give half a speech and then stop them because it's your pleasure to do it? It's like the technology we have today when we put it on freeze and we want to go to the bathroom or something and come back and they haven't gone anywhere. Try doing that to yourself if you have to go to the bathroom. We can't freeze. But that's the kind of power that this text illustrates. And it's not at all surprising that on page 142 of this text, Stern will write, all my heroes are off my hands. It's the first time I've had a moment to spare. I'll make use of it and write my preface. There are not very many books that have the preface on page 142, but it's typical of the kind of wackiness, but also, I want now to say, of the kind of freedom and maneuvering room that this book demonstrates. This book is about the power of writing. It's about also the implements of a story, such as its plot, its characters, all of that being somehow malleable, amenable to the will and shaping power of the writer himself. This kind of stunning mobility, because that's what it is sharply contrasted in this book with the coercive qualities of real life that in fact imprison his characters. And now I'm going to get closer to the novel itself and talk about its title figure, Tristram. The story is about the birth and life of Tristram. Well, that I made it sound easy, the birth and life of Tristram. In fact, Tristram's birth is anything but easy. The first sentence of this book tells us trouble is coming. I wish either my father or my mother, or indeed both of them, as they were in duty both bound to it, had minded what they were about when they begot me. What is he getting at? Well, it turns out that the Stern family, mother and father, have a particular weekly habit. Once a week, they wind up their clock, and once a week, they go through their conjugal duties. Now, this can get you in trouble if you confuse these two operations. And it turns out that at exactly the wrong moment, Mrs. Stern tells her husband, did you wind the clock? And he is interrupted while doing something important. Good God, woman, what an interruption. This is only part of the problem that poor Tristram runs into, because this book suggests that actual biological creatures are subject to all kinds of terrible pressures. And so one of them would be the dispersion of animal spirits at conception. We just saw that. Another would be going through the birth canal, because the cerebellum can be squeezed while Tristram is pulled out by forceps that almost wreck him. Another can be being given the wrong name, and when the father doesn't realize that he's named Tristram, which is terrible. And another can have one of your vital organs, if you're a male, somehow being damaged, and little baby Tristram is taken to the windowsill to pee, and the window falls down, almost castrating him. From all of these points of view, he is going to be a cosmic loser. Now, I said that this book has muscularity, it has mobility, all of that is in the writing, but we see that the character himself is really a kind of determinist victim here. Well, this book, therefore, is interested, it seems to me, in contrasting what kinds of freedom we have versus what kinds of coerciveness and determinism we are subject to. And it's in that light as well that the digressions are so important, because they establish a kind of maneuvering room for the authorial voice. But they also do something else. Stern is interested in trying to free up, emancipate, the power of language. Well, what does that mean, the power of language? The power of language to suggest things beyond its dictionary meanings. So, for example, you'll have a chapter in this book called The Promontory of Noses. Well, what do you think a promontory of noses is? Well, this is a story about a man who rides into a place with a huge nose. And in particular, all of the women in this town go crazy about this man's nose. And at some point, the reader starts to think, well, wait a minute, he's not talking about noses at all, is he? And as well, this book is going to talk much about knots and spigots and whiskers and pump handles. And every one of these, we realize, is a double entendre. It's a kind of suggestive turn that has a kind of sexual innuendo. One of its marvelous chapters has to do with Trim, one of the minor characters, explaining when he was injured with a knee injury, being nursed back to health by this woman called the Fair Beguine, who was rubbing his knee, rubbing it first with one finger, then two fingers, then three fingers, and then above the knee, and then with five fingers, and rubbing it more, rub, 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 and he felt that he was falling in love, he says. And we begin to realize that this rubbing the knee, that the reader is part of a kind of pornography scene, an ejaculation scene. None of that's going to be said. Those are my terms. Stern would say, no, 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 I never wrote that. All of those are instances of what happens with associative thinking. When language suggests, pornography does work the same way. You suggest, you don't. Pornography is not interested in nakedness. It's interested in projecting the image of nakedness. Stern does a verbal version of the same thing, to create something beyond the words themselves. And therefore, it seems to me, that's the great breakthrough of this book, particularly, as I said, because life in the book itself seems to be so coerced. These characters don't get very far, but the book itself has more room than that. And one of the passages I want to read to you has to do with Stern's sense of the kind of miracle he wants to work here. Tell me, ye learned, shall we ever be adding so much to the bulk, so little to the stock? Shall we forever make new books as apothecaries make new mixtures by pouring only out of one vessel into another? There's an effort here to finally make a miracle. Could you make a miracle through language? Well, it's not clear that any of us can see our way to doing that. But Stern wants to try to go that far. Are we forever to be twisting and untwisting the same rope, forever in the same track, forever at the same pace? Shall we be destined to the days of eternity, on holy days as well as working days, to be showing the relics of learning, that's that learned tradition, as monks do the relics of their saints, without working one single miracle with them? Well, how do you work a miracle with language? How do you take the words, pornography, as I said, is one, Bodiness is one. Double entendre says a double meaning. That's one. But I'd suggest that the mind itself is capricious and creative in exactly that light. I'm going to read you one of the wackiest passages that I really like in this book. Think about this. This has nothing to do with Tristram's birth, but it has to do with the speculative powers of thinking, which is that muscularity, that mobility that this book is putting onto the page. "Didst thou ever see a white bear?" cried my father. Now you must wonder, what is this about? A white bear. Very well. Have I ever seen one? Might I ever have seen one? Am I ever to see one? Ought I ever to have seen one? Or can I ever see one? Do you see he's taking the entire grammatical structure and just inserting the white bear and say, how many different ways might it be possible to sort of think about a white bear? If I should see a white bear, what should I say? I mean, these are all in the subjunctive, in the conditional, in the possible. None of this is measurable. If I should never see a white bear, what then? If I never have, can, must, or shall see a white bear alive, have I ever seen the skin of one? Did I ever see one painted, described? Have I ever dreamed of one? Did my father, mother, uncle, aunt, brothers, or sisters ever see a white bear? What would they give? How would they behave? How would the white bear have behaved? Is he wild? Tame? Terrible? Rough? Smooth? This is digressive. It could go on forever. Is the white bear worth seeing? And then a predictable line. Is there no sin in it? Last line. Is it better than a black one? Well, this is the whimsy of this book. To take things and to pirouette them, spin them, and then, I think, launch them into outer space and watch them do their dance there. And it is quite a dance. It's a dance of words doing their own jig, their own minuet. This all comes to a fabulous conclusion late in this book, which recounts the courtship between Uncle Toby, who's one of the key characters in the book, and the widow Wadman. Now, the widow Wadman has a problem. She is death. She's no longer in her youth. Neither is Toby. He's a veteran of the wars, and he's been wounded. He's been wounded. Well, what kind of wound? Turns out he's been wounded in the groin. The widow Wadman would like to know more about this wound. She would like, in particular, since she's thinking of marrying this man, to know what its ramifications are. But of course, she cannot ask him that. She cannot say, "Are you impotent?" which of course is what's on her mind. So, how is she going to get this information out of this man whom she is aggressively courting? He's kind of a fool. So finally, she puts the question, as it were, "Where were you wounded?" Now, Uncle Toby, who was thinking about where he got this wound, which was in Belgium, in the siege of Namur, and he is so obsessed with this battle that he has drawn these enormous maps where he has the town of Namur on the map, and he tells the widow Wadman, "You shall see the very place." She says, "Where were you wounded?" "You shall see the very place. You shall put your finger on it." Of course, the widow Wadman is convinced that he is talking about something quite different. It's a delicious episode. It goes on for many, many pages. But I love that line, "You shall see the very place." That place is ultimately neither the trenches of Namur, nor the map, nor Toby's groin. That place is the place that this book has been talking about all along. It's the place that literature and thinking and language and imagination make possible. That's where these characters live. But this book is punctuated by a narrator who has a vile cough, as indeed Stern himself did. One of the late chapters is about death tracking Stern. And we begin to realize that that's the dialectic of the book. The coercive conditions of a physical body which will die, and the freedom of the mind which can play forever. Thank you.